today's Rewind episode, Sean and I are joined by Kate Moyle, one of the UK's leading psychosexual therapists, to discuss everything sex and fertility. Kate breaks down simple and practical strategies to navigate sex during treatment without losing intimacy with your partner. Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast. Today we are going to talk about all things sex and fertility. We are privileged to be joined by Kate Moyle, psychosexual therapist, also author of The Science of Sex, and fellow podcaster, The Sexual Wellness Sessions. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you. Nice to be back after you guys came on my podcast.
When we decided we wanted to talk about sex on the podcast, you were the top of the list because, as I've just read out, you've got so much experience and we know our listeners are going to take so much from this session. So thank you so much for being here. What is a psychosexual therapist and how did you get into it?
Yeah, so a psychosexual therapist essentially is a talking psychotherapy or a specialist branch of talking psychotherapy where the focus is on sexual relationship difficulties, challenges, experiences. So it's, I describe it like a niche of psychotherapy. It is a talking therapy, it's completely hands-off. So when people think, often people say, oh, you like the mum from Meet the Fockers, it's something very different to that. I absolutely love it because we are experienced, we have medical knowledge, but we're not doctors. So we understand how the body works, we understand about hormones, about neuroscience, but it's very what we call biopsychosocial. So understanding the physical side of it, but also the social side of it, and then the emotional side of it, and where all of those parts collide. And often we're working with both individuals and couples. And as you well know from the conversation we've had before, and where our work crosses over, infertility, trying to conceive, miscarriage, difficulties conceiving, parenthood, all of that stuff really collides with sex and can completely change our sex lives. So that's the focus of today. But obviously, I deal with a huge range of issues, whether they be dysfunctions, anxieties, concerns, a lot of shame, differences in desire, and often differences between partners. How I got into this work was I think it was no surprise to anyone that knew me that I was going to be some kind of psychologist of some sort. I was that kind of, I think, slightly strange child who was always asking a million questions and wanted to know why everyone was thinking that and why that was that way and why that person was doing that. And really, it was quite a kind of academic interest. But one of the things that I really always was fascinated by was why, when you said the word sex or someone said the word sex, that there was this shift in whether it was response or body language or tone. And I was always left wondering, like, where the people that struggle with this part of their lives are going for that help. And I discovered psychosexual therapy, initially trained as a psychosexual therapist, then a relationship therapist, did my European psychosexologist qualifications. And it's really just built from there. And I've now been in the field for over 10 years.
It's an interesting path. Do you often find that in terms of relationship and sex, are they often discussed together? Because you've mentioned them both. But my head's automatically thinking, I'm happy to talk about my relationship to most people, but my sex life is a completely different thing. Obviously, I'm going to talk about it tonight, maybe, but I'm prepared for that from a male perspective. Are men more willing to talk about relationships and their sex lives?
Yeah, I work with a lot of people that are single is one of the first things also to say. This is not an area of therapy which is exclusively for people in relationships. One of the things that we often talk about when we say sex, or people assume when we say sex, is that it's only a partnered experience. And actually, fundamentally, our primary sexual relationship we have is with ourselves. I guess when people get to the point of coming to see someone like me, they're ready inevitably to start talking about sex. I always say the invisible sign above the door is it's okay to talk about sex here. But as with all therapies, I get approached by people when they're ready or when there's been an event in their lives or a trigger. And one of my first questions to people is, why now? Why the inquiry now? Why reaching out now? And so I think by the time that kind of people get into the therapy room, which is a huge step in itself, one of the things I always say is I have never underestimate how hard it is to send that first email to say, I think I need help with this, is that people are in general ready to tackle what they're there to speak about. But we typically might feel more able to talk about relationships or communication or intimacy. We often use these words, sex and intimacy, interchangeably. They're actually very different things, but they obviously relate, but one, they're not the same thing. And we can have sex without intimacy and intimacy without sex. But I'm often working with people, A, who are single. They might have also just had a relationship end for some reason. They want to work on this stuff before they think about another relationship. Or I'm working with one partner in the relationship rather than both if they're in a relationship. But for me, I'm separately qualified in both specifically so that I can have all of the conversations, because I felt personally like I couldn't do my job to the best of my ability without relationships being a part of the conversations about sex and sex being a part of the conversations about relationships. But that was my personal take on it. Not all psychosexual therapists are also relationship therapists, and not all relationships are also psychosexual therapists.
Hmm. I think that distinction between intimacy and sex is really important one. And I'm not going to delve too much on that now because I have a feeling it's something that's going to come up later. Do you get men come to you and open up? Has it traditionally been something you struggle with, and is it getting better, or has it always been there?
Yeah, I have a huge number of male clients. I'm probably about 50-50 in terms of kind of the genders of the clients that are approaching me. Because of my specialism really has become kind of sexual dysfunction. So working with people with sexual anxiety, sexual dysfunctions, and erectile dysfunction is, if you ask people like define a sexual dysfunction or name a sexual dysfunction, erectile dysfunction would probably be the top of the list for both men and women. We have a really common understanding in society of what that means, how that might be approached, how that might be dealt with. And a lot of people, men particularly, if they're experiencing something like that, would try and seek help for that quite immediately. They feel like it's something, if they can't solve on their own, that they want to seek advice on. But it's also quite well known that's something that can be worked on. And so actually approaching psychosexual therapy is very common for people with erectile dysfunction. Often once they've seen a GP or had a testosterone check or an examination or seen a urologist, or once they know there's nothing physically going on, yes, we would say in general that men might find these things a bit trickier to talk about. But when it comes to sex, really, I wouldn't say that there's such a disparity. It's still pretty taboo for everybody. There are different kind of elements of what are going on. But also, there's so much shame now for men. A lot of it is wrapped up about masculinity, about performance. Performance anxiety is a huge kind of body of work in my practice. And this idea that we are in some way not fulfilling our role if we are unable to achieve the level of sexual functioning that we think that we again, I'm going to say these words in inverted commas, and should be in order to be not failing. Again, another word that's in inverted commas, because these are the language that I'm hearing from people all the time.
Do you think that porn has a big input and reason behind that? Performance anxiety, that should...
I think that it absolutely plays a role in particularly what we're seeing now is that it's a lot of people's first access to information about sex. And what we know is that the sex that people are having in real life versus the sex that we're seeing portrayed in pornography are not a good, it wasn't designed to be an educational material. It was designed to create arousal. And I'll never know who said this, but someone said, watching porn to learn about sex is like trying to learn to drive from watching The Fast and the Furious. And I think that it's a good analogy because, yes, both might involve cars and driving, but they are completely different. Yes, pornography and sex might have on the surface some similarities, but they're different entities. And yes, they may collide at some point, but they set up unrealistic, perhaps, expectations because they are not realistic representations. And I think that the pressure that we see that people feel under to do with performance is also beyond that. It's Netflix, it's social media, it's these perfect bodies that we're seeing all the time. It is all of these kind of expectations that we put on ourselves and that we perceive that society puts on us as well. And really at the moment, it feels like we're in a place socially of claiming more vulnerability and being more open about failures. We've seen that with social media. It was all perfectionism. And now we're coming out the other side and everyone's saying, okay, it's not so perfect. I'll show you the not so perfect bits. But there is huge pressure on people to be productive and achieving all of these goals and this very goal-orientatedness of everything right now, this productivity model, and sex falls under that banner as well.
Are you seeing that younger men are finding it more pressurized, or is it throughout the generations? Because my perception is that younger people, because they're using social media more, they're brought up with social media, obviously porn's more available to them than it was when we were kids and things like that. Are they finding it more difficult than, say, the millennials like me and Sean's generation?
Yeah, we don't have the research for previous generations. We were talking earlier about being millennials and like having dial-up internet. It was very different for all of us when we were kids. But it's this sense of, I think there is, yes, a difference. Every generation has its moments. We talk about the generation that lived through the AIDS crisis, obviously had a huge kind of impact on people's sex lives. The generation, the pill being the first sexual revolution of the 60s, we see that there are the generations who've had smartphones for the first time, we see that there are these big shifts, these big contextual changes. But there's also something around people who are growing up with the internet that are more savvy. They have a better understanding of the differences between these things. But what, for me, we're really missing is the education gap. We're not going to be able to delete it from the internet. It's an absolutely huge percentage of the internet. So the gap is where we help people to know what they're using, why they're using it, and this gap between the expectations that might be set by that and actually the reality of sexual experiences. But sexual anxiety is definitely high. We see that generation on generation, decade on decade, from the NatSal survey, which is the biggest survey we have of UK sex lives, but for the last 30 years, every 10 years, the survey is showing that people are reporting having less sex, which is an interesting thing for us to be considering as well. And again, how is that being measured? Because perhaps we were saying, okay, sex is only intercourse on the survey 30 years ago, and now people are saying, oh, but we're having sex online, or we're apart, or we're having phone sex, we're having virtual sex. They might consider it sex, but the survey historically might not have done. So when we're thinking about sex research, a lot of this is about open questions and thinking, okay, what does that mean? Or what do we think is affecting people? But there's one thing that I would say is that almost everybody who walks through my clinic doors is dealing with some kind of anxiety around sex in some way, shape, or form. If we could get down to the lowest common denominator, it's a worry about sex, whether that's to do with shame, worrying is they're normal, if they're good at sex, what their partner's thinking, is their body normal? These are the kind of the really basic underlying questions underneath it all.
Yeah, when you're saying about online pornography being so prevalent, I heard or read somewhere, and I can't provide a reference, but the Pornhub, it has more hits in the UK than LinkedIn. That it's not going anywhere. I just want to go back to cover off something about the erectile dysfunction. So I can certainly speak from the physiological and hormonal aspects. When I was really struggling with my low testosterone post having a microtesy, like having no libido and not getting sporadic and certainly not morning erections and stuff like that, that it was utterly miserable. Is there any top level advice you can give anyone, or just signposting for anyone who's struggling with that right now?
Yeah, so one of the things is, if we took that as an example, that what you just gave, that you have a kind of a reason for why things aren't currently working, a medical reason, a signpost. What also can happen when you come out of that is, even if that kind of gets corrected, so say a hormone level gets corrected, often you're still dealing with the psychological impact of having just been through a time when you've been worrying about sex, or you've been feeling low about it, or it doesn't suddenly just go away because the medical difficulty has been fixed or the imbalance has been fixed. And that, for me, it's a really useful example for where these kind of worlds clash. One thing that is really important for people to know is, if you've had a sudden change in erections and erection quality, so you've gone from having quite consistent nocturnal and morning erections, so the erections you wake up with in the morning are basically the nocturnal erections that you have throughout the night. They happen during periods of REM sleep, and it's thought that it's to do with oxygenation of tissue, so keeping kind of tissue healthy, etc. If that suddenly changes, that's something you should be going to see your GP about ASAP, because some of the blood vessels in the penis are some of the smallest ones, and it could be an indicator of something else going on, like a cardiovascular issue or something like that. But the occurrence of these morning erections, nocturnal erections, declines very gradually with age. So we expect them to be much less frequent or lower in people in their 60s, for example, than in their 20s. We see a gradual testosterone decline over age as well, starting from the 30s onwards. But it's about knowing your normal. If you know that something isn't working for you or something has suddenly changed, get it checked out. Don't avoid going to your doctor because it's to do with your genitals, because you feel embarrassed, because you feel ashamed about it. It's, you know, your doctor doesn't care what part of your body that you're there to talk about. But so many people leave sexual difficulties or concerns about their genitals much longer than they would do another health concern. And so knowing your normal, if you feel like something has changed and something has quite suddenly changed, please go and get it checked out.
Yeah, I think that's really such great advice, as knowing your normal and encouraging people to go to the doctors. They are so professional, and that they don't care what body part you're going about.
I find that my libido is definitely affected by stress levels significantly. For a while, I was worried, like probably in my mid-20s, I was like, what's wrong? And then I realized, obviously, I'm going for this fertility treatment and all this stress, and it was up and down. I had all the right checks and everything was all right. So I was able to identify that it was a stress thing. But getting to know what your normal is a key bit of advice, I think, anything in terms of your sexual health or just your health in general, because health can be a funny thing. Your body responds in funny ways. We've talked briefly about performance anxiety. Now, see, with infertility, men have to go and give samples, and they've talked very openly on the podcast about how stressful that is and the pressure that you feel. And the guests that we've had on have also talked about it. If a guy is generally anxious about going to give a semen analysis because he's worried about performance, is there any tips you could give him just to prepare himself, maybe to get mentally ready for it?
I think the thing is, it's not just the anxiety in the moment. It's the what could this result show? What could this mean? Could this be happening because of me? All of the fear that goes with that. It is not just a sample. It's the potential of what that means. And there's so much anxiety attached to that. And often when people have got to the point of going to first semen analysis or going to give a sample, it's not the thing that you do after you've been trying for 3 weeks. It's already you're getting to the point where you're worried, or you've been having conversations, or things haven't been going that smoothly, or you're worried about something, or you're having recurrent miscarriages or not getting pregnant. It's not an isolated incident. And so it's not just quite as simple as that. As we all know, and something I've shared with the two of you before and on podcasts, is I've been through my own experience of infertility. So not only do I work with lots of couples who have been through this, but it's also something I have a kind of personal take on. But for a start, it's such a novel experience. You're in a quite sterile room. In sometimes you can hear other people in the waiting rooms or in the corridors. You can hear people walking down, that you have to put your sample into a cupboard, and there feels something quite strange about that. And this kind of, it's not most people's idea of an arousing situation, which is when they would usually be masturbating or having a sexual experience. So giving yourself a break for feeling like that, for the first thing, is not pulling yourself apart for having the anxiety, for having the nerves about it. Working out if there's something that helps you to switch on to a more kind of sexual mode, but understanding that this is probably not going to be a perfect sexual experience for you. And then it might feel quite functional, but if that's what you need to do in that moment, then that's fine. That don't give it the same weight as you would give a sexual experience with a partner. And if it's something like knowing that there is something that you really, that's going to help you in that moment, because it's all going to be about the type of stimulation that you're doing and having your mind on your side and your head in the right place. If there's something that helps you to do that, take it with you and just do what you need to do to try and focus your attention on that. And inevitably, there is going to feel like there's a lot of pressure on it or a lot of weight on it because of what it means or what it could mean. And also the unknown. There's so much infertility treatment, and particularly at the start, which is unknown. And it feels really scary. You're walking into a dark tunnel and you don't know if there's light at the end, how long it is, how long you're going to be in there, what's going to happen. And it's, again, still quite an unspoken thing. We've seen the silence around miscarriage, the silence around infertility, and the conversation is shifting. But I would say further behind on the male side than it is on the female side still.
Yeah. Mentioned like the pressure and the potential outcome. That I gave so many samples, I literally lost count. But the time that I couldn't, was there was a lot resting on that one, because I'd had a varicocele embolization 3 months before. And that was the first medical intervention that we had. And we were so hopeful that we had put all of our hope into it, that it was going to work. Because if you haven't got hope, then what have you got, really? And yeah, we just put all of our faith in it, that it was going to work. And as the weeks got closer and closer, the anxiety grew. I got there, and as soon as I got in my own head, I was in there for about 45 minutes, but I probably knew after 3 or 4 or 5 that it wasn't going to work. I think I was next to the staff room at that point. I could hear them talking through there. And then your mind starts going crazy. Are they thinking about me? Are they talking about me? Is it because I've been in here for so long? Yeah. So once I got into my head, I was never getting out of it. And it's like what you mentioned about going to a GP. They're so professional. They deal with this every day, but it's hard to find that rational mind in that moment when you're panicking and then literally trying to leg it out. And then having to phone my wife to say that I couldn't manage it, and thinking she'd be angry with me. Of course she wasn't. Of course the people at the clinic weren't anything but professional when I phoned them to say, look, can I come back? This is all just part of breaking that silence. And we did a whole episode on it, literally on giving samples. And sometimes some of my friends who haven't been through fertility struggles say, oh, I must listen to your pod. I'm like, seriously, I appreciate the support. If you want to, you can, but you don't have to. But what I would say is listen to a series 1, episode 3, because every bloke can relate to that in some respect. Going to masturbate somewhere, perhaps not in such extreme circumstances or bizarre, but yeah, that's what we're all about, is letting guys know that we've been there. It's completely normal. It's about trying to find what works for you in that situation.
Most people are masturbating for pleasure, and it's the complete opposite end of the scale. And it's often something that we see as psychosexual therapists when people are struggling with something like erectile dysfunction. This is wider picture rather than just for semen analysis, is testing behaviors. And so it's, I'm just going to check if everything's working. I'm just going to try that. And what you're doing is you are trying to masturbate, which is something which is associated with pleasure and arousal, but with a kind of anxious lens on it, which actually interrupts your ability to be aroused. And so you're not actually checking erection quality under arousing circumstances. You're testing it under anxious circumstances. Now, we can understand with something like going to give a semen sample or for semen analysis that it's strange circumstances, that this wouldn't be our kind of choice for how we did it, or it doesn't feel natural. And I would just say, like, sex is always in context. And so if you are feeling really nervous about it, go with the idea of also being like, yeah, no wonder. Like, of course I feel a bit nervous about it, or weird about it, or anxious about it, particularly if it's early on. I've never really done this before. No one's ever said, here's your cup, off you go to the room. Again, it's a kind of a strange situation to be in, because you're being given permission to be sexual, but it's not sexual, but no one talks about sex. And so it's this kind of very strange set of circumstances. And I think it's why people who are in the infertility community connect on it, because everyone's, yeah, isn't it just such a strange experience to have? And no one who's really been in it can really understand the nuances of what it's like.
Yeah, you've said something really powerful there, and that is being kind to yourself about the situation. Because you feel like all the pressure. And if I think back now, I turned up for my first semen analysis. I was led to a room by a woman who was probably like 50 years old, handed a cup and said, we'll be downstairs when you finish. And it's like, how can, no one's ever done that to me before. That kind of acknowledgement of, yeah, this is a strange situation. You're here for a purpose. It's not going to be as enjoyable as your previous experiences. I think if I'd had that mindset, and I'd say as well that the more samples I did, the more comfortable I got with the situation, but it never felt natural. But yeah, it's a great bit of advice in terms of being kind to yourself, because it is tough.
And in all sexual experiences, when we get to a place where we're thinking more about performance than we are about pleasure, that's a massive kind of sexual circuit breaker. It's a real interrupter. You're so in your head, you're not really able to be in your body. And we see that. We're going to get onto the conversation, obviously, about how infertility and stuff can change sex lives. But it's a perfect example of kind of how acute the performance in that moment can feel, and how someone who's also never had a problem with erections or sex or ejaculating ever before can be in that situation and be thinking, this just isn't going to happen. I can't believe this isn't going to happen. And this is the one day I needed it to happen. And that shows like the power of the mind and how sex is always in context. And so if you're in a context which is changing how you feel about what you're doing, of course you can be affected by that.
Yeah. And I think perfectly segued into where I was going, actually, because we've talked about going to give a sample. And as you said, Kate, that's not usually something you do after a couple of weeks. It's often after a year, 18 months, 2 years of trying. And anyone who's experienced that will know that pressure. And when you were just saying there, like people who haven't had previous problems, it's like in the sexual context, I was almost just mentally going, yeah, tick, like erectile dysfunction, struggling to ejaculate, because that pressure mounts with every week, every month that goes on, every phone call, which didn't happen too often, but for my wife saying, where are you? Can you come home now? Because she had done an ovulation test, and like, where, how quickly did you get that? I was part of it, I guess it. But what that does then is give me that the time it took me to get home. It was just the pressure was increasing. So how do you navigate that when you're dealing with an individual or a couple who is in that phase of trying to conceive? Where do you go with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a big topic. And I think actually it's a topic that doesn't get covered enough, because most people, when they start trying to conceive, trying, that dreadful phrase, is most people are hopeful, probably a bit naive, which is a good thing to be when you're starting out on that process. And we all hear stories about people that got pregnant within a week, and this happened to my sister, and my mum was fine, and this, and it's very much, we surround ourselves and everyone's hopeful, because of course we are. That's the point when we are intentionally trying to get pregnant. And it can very quickly move from something quite fun, where there's a lot of anticipation, excitement. We're thinking, is this going to be the time? We're having more sex perhaps than we usually do. We're thinking about like, the possibility. And it can move from fun to functional very quickly. And we're navigating a kind of roller coaster of month on month disappointment. Then we might start to question. That can happen super quickly. Even some people, they might be thinking after a couple of months, why isn't this happening? I thought it would happen by now. And it doesn't take very much. Now, also, obviously, people are having sex around kind of window of ovulation, which means that a sex life that previously might have felt more, not necessarily spontaneous, but more that they haven't really thought about it. It's like we're in the same place at the same time, or we went out for dinner, whatever it is. It feels like it's more random. Suddenly can become very focused, and that can make both partners feel a little bit like they're being used for a sexual purpose rather than this is something we do because we are attracted to each other. We love each other. We're interested in each other. We think each other are hot, etc. So that can happen very quickly. And the more that goes on for, we absolutely start to see this kind of what used to be a positive anticipation becoming a kind of more anxious or more negative anticipation, because it can feel so functional. And one of the things that I often talk to couples about is making sure that they approach each other at other times apart from just the window of ovulation. Because what happens very quickly is all intimate sexual contact and what we call sexual currency, which is everything you do with a partner, which isn't sex, but positively contributes to your sex life, becomes rooted around that. So couples stop kissing randomly or touching each other apart from when it is a precursor for sex around the period of ovulation. And then it feels like it tails off and they wait for 2 weeks and a little bit longer. And then they they're in that waiting period and they might not be showing much interest in each other during that time. And that feeds in again to the, oh, we only have sex because of the results that we hope that it's going to get us rather than how we used to. And we see that desire changes typically for couples across relationships anyway, but this is a very particular type of shift. And one of the things that also becomes very attached to that when we're talking about anxiety or particularly kind of performance anxiety is there can become a lot of weight on orgasm, on ejaculation, on having to achieve that, having to hit every day or every other day during the ovulation window. It feels very goal orientated. But then particularly if it's attached to things like miscarriage or early pregnancy tests that show positive and then go away. And then there's also often partners can feel an emotional responsibility for their partner's feelings. It becomes attached to sex can become related to something painful, something emotionally difficult, something challenging. And there's also a fear that becomes attached to that, which is, God, that's been really difficult for us. I'm scared. And I'm scared that we're going to get to that place again. And that fear can get caught up with sex as well.
Yeah. Me and my wife had a very similar situation when we were just going through cycles of treatment. Like, we distanced ourselves. It wasn't that we were trying to conceive because we knew we couldn't, but it was the fear of, I wouldn't say fear, but we just naturally became more distant because of all the pressure that was going on. And when we actually sat down and had the conversation of, we're drifting apart here physically, we were still together as a couple, still very strong, but we weren't as intimate. And like you've described, we weren't hugging each other as much and kissing each other as much. And just, I can't even explain why, it just naturally occurred. But when we actually had the conversation of it, we found that our mental health got a lot better. We started to feel more as a couple again. And it made coping with the situation we were in a lot easier, if that makes sense. And it's because we were doing things that we're built to do, aren't we? We're built to be intimate with a partner. We have that natural drive. And it wasn't for the conception for us. It was more the fact of when we were going through that treatment. It made a big difference to us just to plan out and be like, let's just go out and do what we used to do. And when we really analysed it, that we were told you can't have sex here and here because you're going in for your treatment. And I still think about it now. The worst thing that would have happened was we would have got pregnant. We knew that couldn't happen, but that would have been a miracle and would have been amazing. But yeah, it was a really difficult time and put a lot of other strains on our relationship. But we, having that open conversation really helped. And do you find that couples are open to having that conversation once they've talked to you? Or if you've got someone that comes into you, like a guy in my situation, going through fertility, got maybe performance anxiety, once they've talked to you, are they more willing to go then talk to their partners more openly? Or do you find they've already done that before they get to you?
Yeah, often I think people are looking for ways to know how to talk about it. And often we can have the conversations in therapy that feel like they're practicing or giving someone confidence to have them a bit more at home. But also, one of the things is people come to me and they say, I feel like sex is changing, or I've got performance anxiety, I'm really worried about this, it's not working, or you feel like we've drifted apart. You know, a little bit of me, the kind of initial bit is, no shit, look what you're going through. IVF, infertility, it's all consuming. And often partners can go to their own positions. And particularly if we see that medical treatment is heavily weighted on one partner rather than the other, there can be a sense of resentment that one of you is going through it all and then the other one isn't really, or partners can feel like their partner is showing, and it might not be actually because they don't want it so much, but because of the different ways that they deal with their emotions or they deal with their communication. They're like, you don't want this as much as I am, or you don't seem as disappointed as I am, and this is worse for me. We can get the person that we're closest to, we can feel very far apart from. And you gave the perfect example there, which is as soon as you started to externalize it and you're like, oh, the infertility is the problem rather than either of us, you externalize it and it triangulates that conversation and you feel closer in your joint approach to tackling the thing that's happening between you rather than the problem in each other, if that makes sense. But Absolutely. I think we aren't taught how to have these conversations at all. And particularly if we're dealing with our own experience of feeling like we are the one who, again, we're going to use this word, but is failing or failed. We feel the responsibility of that if we're the partner whose body isn't working in the way that it was designed to, or we're the one that's struggling, or and we feel a huge weight of that. And that can also make us feel like we're pulling apart from our partners more, or that we don't feel able to feel as close to them because of the what we're personally going through.
Yeah.
What I experienced, I said earlier about going to give samples, but when I was getting into my own head, and men can't fake it, essentially, when I was struggling to ejaculate because of the pressure of like, just, it was just mounting. And then once I was there, like I said, with the example around giving a sample, I would know almost immediately it wouldn't happen, because then the only place I am is in my head. I'm not experiencing that pleasure throughout my body. And that would bleed into the next one. And because before I'd even got there, I imagine this is quite common. Like before it's I'd even cycle. Started. Yeah, it was. And it's horrible. And the only way I got myself out of that was by communicating with my wife that it was just that pressure. And we just took a bit of a break. And that was key in that respect of kind of guys who are experiencing the same, not taking anything away from how long this may take to unpick. But is there any takeaways, top level advice that we can give today?
Yeah, I think top level advice is try and maintain a level of, we're going to go with the assumption that these are people in relationships, because that sounds like it's a couple centric question, but go with trying to make sure that there is some level of connection between you and your partner, not at times that are completely focused on sex as a route to something else or sex as a route to conception, because there's nothing that's going to make you feel, both of you, less wanted, less of interest to your partner, that you're no longer looking attractive to your partner, or that your relationship is strong enough to get through it, if the bits that were good before feel like they're completely falling away. And we have to be honest about this. A lot of couples do break up through these processes. A lot of couples don't make it through. It's not all happy endings. We all know that. People don't get the children that they hope for or that they dream of, or they go through numerous levels of medical interventions and hormones and drug treatments and medical procedures and operations. We know that there's not always this kind of happy ending that we would like there to be for everyone. But when you are so in your head and so preoccupied, continuing just to try and do the same thing again and again without changing anything is only going to make it worse, because that's how anxiety works. It's an anticipation of something that you are afraid of, or that you're treating as a potential threat. Now, remembering the back part of your brain, this kind of historical part of your brain, doesn't understand actually that your partner is not a threat to you. That just understands that the risk of failing at this feels detrimental to your mental health, feels bad for you. And your brain's job is to keep you safe, not to keep you happy. And so it's relating sex and sex with your partner becomes related to something which you have a kind of threat response to, so to speak. So working out how to make it feel safe again, which might be saying, can we just have a month without penetrative sex, or can we just agree to lie in bed together and just talk and kiss and touch and not take it any further, or can we just agree to go and do something that we used to do before this, or to say, can we have a night where we sit and have dinner and we don't talk about IVF, or what is it that's going to help us to feel a little bit more like ourselves? Because fertility treatment makes you feel not like yourself. And a lot of people get to a point where they don't even recognize the person that they are and the thoughts that they're having. So working out those little ways that feel possible is really important. But as you said, this vicious cycle, because if you then start to struggle, and this is performance anxiety 101, is the more anxious you are, the more likely that's going to interrupt your clinical term, but normal sexual functioning. And then you're going to be so in your head, you're going to struggle to perform in the way that you want to or expect yourself to. So there's more pressure. And then when that doesn't happen, you feel even worse. And then if you feel even worse, the next time you go into the situation, you're saying to yourself, that thing that happened last time can't happen again. And so you are then in an increased kind of anxious state. If during that cycle, you also haven't told your partner what it is that's going on, you haven't been able to communicate it about it, you're then thinking, oh, what are they going to think if that doesn't happen again? Because not only am I going to have to deal with my reaction, we're going to have to deal with their response. I feel even more pressure now. And then often, particularly when there's difficulties with ejaculation, people are trying to get checking on their bodies all the time. Is it working? Am I nearly there? Have I got an erection? Is it going to last? Am I going to get there? How's that doing? And it's, again, even that kind of thinking becomes a distraction. And the irony we know in these situations is focusing on the pleasure and being in your body fully is the thing that's most likely to take you to peak pleasure, to the point of orgasm, to the point of ejaculation. But if you are hugely distracted and distressed and having all of these thoughts, you're going to be in your head and not in your body. It's, the irony is when it becomes goal orientated, when we focus on ejaculation or orgasm as a goal, we're actually less likely to achieve it.
Yeah, that's such great advice. And yeah, I felt that was a really interesting point about the brain just trying to keep us safe. I guess that's the amygdala with the kind of threat assessment of this is giving you anxiety, it's giving you psychological harm. Don't put yourself in a situation. That's really interesting. And shows how deep this stuff goes, really, doesn't it?
It's not functional to have sex when you're highly stressed. There's like a threat. It's not, that's not going to help you. Like lying down and having sex when you're really under threat is not going to be a life-saving way of helping yourself. It's not going to be a good coping mechanism. Your priorities are going to be somewhere else. But it's also very easy because of the social taboo, kind of shame, pressure, lack of conversation, lack of normalized conversation that we have around sex that makes it worse. What is it that makes one person who has an episode of erectile dysfunction who says, oh, I heard it happens to everyone, I'd had quite a lot to drink, or I was really stressed about work, or I knew when I started I wasn't really in the right headspace. What's the difference between the person who's able to brush that off and the person who holds on to that with two hands and goes into their next sexual experience really nervous and preoccupied, unable to focus, super distracted? A combination of contextual factors, experience, genetics, personality, the response of the partner in that moment, so many things. That they watched a TV episode about a guy who couldn't get it up and it just happened. That was like actually their worst nightmare. And then they were like, that's going to happen to me. All of these things colliding all the time. And again, happening in context of, in general, we don't see conversations about sex, having good days, bad days, average days, happening. We don't really see, we know sexual dysfunction, you know, that sex doesn't work sometimes, but we don't really think it happens to people like us or people that we know. We don't really think it's a normal inverted commas experience. We think that we overestimate how much we think other people are having sex versus how much we're having sex. And we don't see any versions of sex not working or not being how these glamorized or non-representative versions of sex. Anyway, we assume that sex is meant to look a certain way, be a certain way, and then we must be the only one or the person failing if our sex life doesn't look that way. And something that I say a lot, and that is my experience as a therapist, and bear in mind therapy is confidential, so people get to a certain point where they seek out therapy, which tends to be further down the line than they would like it to be when they've got to quite a peak of distress, is isolation. Any difficulties with sex, people feel hugely isolated in, because they don't feel like there is support around, that they see other people having these experiences, that they hear about them. And often when people start talking about them, and this is why I had you guys on my podcast, because I think it's hugely important, is if they have feel like they can start to talk about it, or they say to a friend, I'm really struggling about this, they suddenly realize that actually these problems are not that uncommon in some way, shape or form, but the conversations about them are really lacking. We know that how often people are struggling with sex versus how often the conversations happening about people struggling with sex, we know that there's a huge gap between those two things.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. in terms of trying to normalize the discussion about how, well, people's sex lives, like even if it's just between friends, because we mentioned it briefly, but normally when guys talk to their mates about their sex lives, it's a bit of banter and a bit of messing around. And I can't actually remember, probably me and Sean have had more honest conversations, but with my long-term friends, I don't think I've ever sat down and talked to them about what my sex life is like, or if I've had an issue, or and if I have, it's always ended up with a bit of banter, even when I've not wanted it to. I feel like we've discussed loads tonight, Kate. We've really covered a lot. And as I said at the beginning of the episode, it was going to be a valuable episode that our listeners could get a lot from, and it hasn't disappointed. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. We always do finish on one final question, though, and that is, if you could give one bit of advice, let's say in terms of sex challenges, to a man who is facing fertility struggles, what would that bit of advice be?
Only one.
Yeah, only one.
My main bit of advice would be, don't think that the help isn't available. Don't think that you are the only one struggling with this. Don't think that there's support that you can't get. Because I think particularly when we see that infertility gets rooted in a lot of messages about what a woman's body should do, what a man's body should do. And if we take on the personal failure for what our body isn't doing, we feel like we are the problem, and therefore we can't find any help for that, or we can't find any support for that. The support is absolutely there. And don't deny yourself that, whether it's a podcast episode, a book, a therapy session, a group, or whatever it is, because you will realize that even if people are having different experiences to you, the feelings that they are having underneath those experiences are highly likely to be very similar to how you're feeling. And other people's stories can be really helpful. And I think I say healing, I don't mean healing because it's very difficult to heal when you're in quite a traumatic environment or you're really struggling with something, or you know that you're not at the end of something. But don't feel like there isn't anything there that can help you. The sex specific stuff is, open up a channel of communication with your partner, even if you find it the absolute hardest thing to do and it's the last thing you feel like doing, because your partner will have their version of what's going on. They will have a version of what they think is going on in your head. It's probably not very likely to be what's going on in your head. And you will have your version of what you think is going on in their head. And then on top of that, what you think is going on in their head about what's going on in your head. And so the only thing that the two of you can work with is assumption. And your assumptions are probably not going to be great if you're in this really difficult time and going through a lot. And you have to challenge that assumption, because we have these gaps where we assume, we fill them with information, typically quite negative information. The only way you're going to be able to challenge that is by clarifying with each other, with sitting down and be like, shall we have a difficult conversation? I'm really struggling with this. How are you doing? And you'll probably find that you don't feel that differently, but you just don't have the tools to know how to do it.
That's the perfect advice. And what you've just said in terms of the assumptions is true. There were several cases where I thought Jen, my wife, was thinking one thing and she was thinking something completely different in terms of treatment and vice versa. So yeah, getting that support and it is there. Talk. It's perfect advice.
It's like that saying, I'm not what I think I am. I'm not what you think I am. I am what I think. He's trying to second guess all the time, but yeah, it's incredible. And the way that you can get to the bottom of that is by that communication. That's something that we've probably said in pretty much every episode is key.
Yeah.
So thank you very much.
Kate, if people wanted to get hold of your book or get contact to you, or where can they find your podcast?
Yeah, so the podcast is called The Sexual Wellness Sessions. So every episode is a deep dive into a particular topic to do with sex and relationships. We've series Fits will be out hopefully later this year. My book is called The Science of Sex, and it's part of a series of books by the publishers DK called The Science Of. So it's every page is basically a Q&A. It's a cross between a coffee table book with what I think are quite cool illustrations. But basically a kind of sex ed for adults book. And I'm on Instagram at Kate Moyle Therapy, and my website is my name, which is Kate Moyle.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on, and I'm sure we'll speak to you soon. Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favour and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to cover on the mailbag, drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message and we love hearing from our listeners. And if you'd like a bit more expert guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by guys that get it. For our latest updates, follow us on social media at The Male Fertility Podcast. And remember, gents, you're not on your own.